Hello, and welcome to another episode of The Pedophile Huntress. We're each here tonight with a common goal, that you be encouraged in heart and united in love. We welcome you all. Tonight, back with me for panel discussion number two of Breaking Family Ties is Emily and Carol Boyce, author of First, I Believe You. Last week, well, it was actually a week before that, we began to talk about breaking family ties. It was a very popular broadcast, and it was also one that we barely kind of touched the surface on. So we wanted to come back with you tonight. And I thought, ladies, it would be good if we kind of talked about where we are with our families. And I'll open up. I don't talk a lot about that. I have not seen my brothers or sisters for many years, maybe some of them 10 or more, maybe 15. I think I saw my brother once in kind of a volatile situation because my husband confronted him. After that, he had his fourth heart attack. These are really complicated situations, right? My nephews and nieces, I used to see, but I stayed with them until they grew, just so they knew that they had an advocate on their side. So that's kind of where I stand. I took me and my children and my grandchildren away from my family of origin, and we set sail on a different course. And so that's my path. Carol, why don't you go ahead and open up and tell us where you are right now with your family?
So I'm one of four children. My mother died a long time ago, so she wasn't, she never even heard about this. The sexual abuse. My father passed away just 2 years ago, but I only saw him maybe once or twice, you know, at family events over 30 years, because I remembered about 30 years ago. So didn't see them, it was him at all. And it was real difficult for many reasons. My siblings, I don't tend to see much anyway, but I haven't really been talking to them for the last year or two. And it's really heartbreaking, but
okay.
And
Emily, what's your situation? I think it just helps bring the listener into where we're at and then to go into the discussion. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I have been like completely separated, no communication with the young man who was my abuser since 2016. I had been kind of pressured to stay in touch with him, pressured to communicate through my family up until that point. And finally, I was able to say, that's not okay at that point. And he was framed as my brother. So that's why I bring it up. And then the last communication I had with my parents was June 17th, 2021. I sent them a letter each separately because they were hiding things from each other. So that was a letter I sent to them, certified mail, that I wanted to not have contact with them anymore. And then so that was June 17th, 2021. Then I sent letters to my sister and some other family members following that, just to let them know what was going on. And I had already talked with them on the phone about it all through that year and some of a lot of work that I was doing. So I have not had much contact with my sister since then, just little bits here and there. Like you, Jody, I wanted to stay in touch with my nephews because she has sons, and I feel that they're in a very dangerous situation. And so I almost want them to know, you know, there's someone on the outside and there's a safe person.
There's a predator.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm outside of their system, but hopefully they can see me as a safe person. So I've stayed in touch with them through sending gifts and letters and that kind of thing, but not actual visits, which is really difficult.
Go ahead. Nope.
I don't have any other siblings, just my one sister. But I am in touch more closely with some extended family. One second cousin who is very supportive, and so that's good to have that. But I'm still trying to figure out some relationships with like aunts and uncles. It's ongoing. Like even now, we're trying to decide about an aunt that wants to come visit, and okay, what does that look like? So I'm kind of concluding we're going to meet in a neutral space, like a park that's not in our city, and have a picnic and have it not be anything too personal. So,
right. And that, yeah, I mean, it is very complicated. And that's kind of why I wanted us to talk about that for a minute. I've been on this healing journey for a long time, since about 35, and then really kind of stepped into it. Probably 40, 45, and just said, I've got to, because it takes a long time to decide that you're going to leave family, because right where one of the things that family gives you is a sense of connection. It gives you a sense of belonging. Yeah. And the other thing about having a family unit, as I thought about this, you guys, after we talked last time, was it really gives us a lack of accountability, because the family unit cohesively together kind of brings accountability. So when you step out of that family unit, you're on your own. You're on your own for your story. You're on your own for your healing. You know what I mean? So talk to me a little bit about that. It's interesting. You have to find, so accountability becomes really strong. You are accountable for every action you take. It just feels, I don't know, like 100 pounds more heavy every step that you take in the beginning. Uh-huh. But then it's also hard to find connection and belonging when you step away from your family. So talk to me a little bit about that.
I think that's the heartbreak of it is, you know, I think we're all biologically wired to want that family and to belong. That's our kind of sense of safety. And so mentally it's very, very hard not to have that. And it shows a lot of growth, I think, when you do start letting go of some of these primary relationships in your life. When you feel like, you know, I can handle this, I believe in myself and my narrative enough that I can stand up for myself. And most of us did not when we were little, you know, we were never taught that. So,
100%.
I think that's an important aspect of it. And I think specifically to incest, it is, you know, when it's intra-family, it is so much harder mentally because of the trust and these, you know, primary responsibilities our parents had that they completely let go of. And so it just, it adds to that pain. But the reality is the families don't tend to support us. And the closer they are, I said this last week, the closer they are, the harder it is for them to support us. So.
Right. That's huge. And we'll talk about that in a minute when, after Emily goes, I do want to talk about what the relationships look like, because they really aren't supportive. And yet
they
still give us connection and belonging. They're separate things, but go ahead, Emily.
Yeah, I was thinking about it, and I've talked a lot with my therapist about this. The thing is that I think my grandparents really knew me. I think the ones I spent so much time with, I think they really knew me, and we had a actual authentic family connection. And what's interesting is my grandfather passed away in 2014 and my grandmother passed away in 2016. And I think that was actually the start of me really realizing I didn't fit in my family, and I didn't want to be there anymore, because they were really my primary bond or connection there. And I realized that my family and I never really knew each other, or they didn't know me. They never really knew me. So it was a very grievous process, though, to realize I never really had a family, you know, like that true belonging in a nuclear family. But it's true. I've thought about it a lot. Like, I am not very attached to very many people. Like, I'm attached to just a handful of people. And it's an interesting thing because I do believe humans need attachment and we need to be in community and grow through life together and all that. So I know I need to cultivate that in other places and to be mindful of that need of myself, because I've had so little true attachment in my life that I'm almost like fine, right? Like, because that's how it's always been for me.
You know what?
But I don't think it's necessarily good.
No, Carol and I can probably say we 100% understand. One of the things that's interesting that you just said was your grandmother. And, you know, when my grandmother on my mom's side actually was kind of like my angel in the nursery, as they say. I've heard that term, counselors use it. But she definitely was the person who gave me enough to survive. And meeting Jesus when I was just this little tiny girl where nobody even knows how. But I don't know, he just came to my room and visited me. And that's a whole nother story. But when she passed, it's very interesting that I too went away from my family because I had nothing left. And so when we talk about, you guys, what it really looks like, we're sitting at the table with people who usually lie, who are so good at deception that they can make you believe anything. And no matter, they'll just lie. Even if they're caught, they lie to the end and they'll continue to tell the same story. And they'll use your siblings against you. They'll use everything against you to keep their narrative alive, the narrative of what's not healthy and good. And so I think breaking that deception is huge, isn't it? Because the cost of stepping into the truth is stepping outside of the family. Now you're going to be alone and alienated because if you don't keep their narrative, they're not going to keep you around. So talk a little bit about that, right? Because there really is some deception in the family. And I'll say this and then throw the ball back to you guys. But I was talking to my daughter yesterday and she's conservative. And I tend to be very conservative coming from a hellacious, horrible childhood where my parents were incredibly liberal, right? When you can do anything you want sexually, that's, to me, that's pretty liberal.
Pretty liberal.
But guess what? They lived as high, strict conservatives they presented to everybody. So I told her I became this conservative little girl around a bunch of horrible liberals. And they still live that way. I mean, drinking and taking pills and, you know, before my dad died. And she was like, Mom, that's so interesting because dad, her father, always acted conservative, but he was terribly liberal. He slept with men. He slept with women, you know, while he was married to me. We could go on and on and on. So there is this weird dichotomy where what they represent is totally and 100% wholeheartedly not who they are. Does that resonate with you guys?
My parents were pretty conservative and they didn't have that kind of wild left kind of, or, you know, that other side. So I think it kind of shows every family is unique, you know.
But having your father come to your room every night, wouldn't you call that? That's quite a liberty. Yeah. So that's what I mean. You see
that's
what I'm
true.
Saying, though?
That's true.
So, It's actually not true that he was conservative. When you go into your daughter's room to rape her, that's as liberal as the territory gets, as far as I'm concerned. You see what I'm saying? So it is this dichotomy where you even believed they were conservative. That's not conservative. Not by any stretch of the imagination.
No, but they were very, you know, they're strict. And I know.
I know what you're saying.
You know, they had, the household was very tightly run and, you know, and many, many good things about that. But I did want to say that what I hear, I think the biggest loss that we have is this maternal figure. You know, I think this kind of not feeling like you belong in a family is because there was not that nurturing, that piece of understanding you. Is kind of more typically mother driven and
that's really good,
you know, and I see that, you know, this kind of idea that mother kind of is the glue in that in families frequently, not to, you know, make it a the only way that role can be fill out, but that's what it frequently is. And I think it kind of shows that the mothers were also just not doing that piece of the family. So then there isn't anything really there, you know?
Well, see, and that's all part of this deception though. They keep the deception alive is what makes the cover so good, but what a beautiful part. I think I'm not going to speak for each one of us, but I can certainly tell you there are times in my adult life today where I'll wake up either in physical pain or emotional pain or have a bad dream. And you know what I'll think in my heart? I wish I had a mom. I wish I had a mom.
Yeah,
I don't. Too. I've never had a mother that came and comforted me ever. I don't even know what that feels like. Emily, go ahead and talk about that for a minute.
Okay, there are a lot of things. So I was thinking about... you know, I feel like my parents have this self-ideal of who they want to be and who they want the world to see them as. Mm-hmm. And they feel a very big obligation to do certain things that they see as being biblical or doing things in the church that are what they believe is right and correcting other people to do those things, things like that. But then the actual heart of it is just not love. And in terms of their lifestyle choices and all that, my parents were conservative and I believe still are. The only thing where I always felt a little weird was my dad's musical choice and his love of watching certain music videos and things like that, that just felt kind of off and yucky to me, you know, not nice. And, in terms of the maternal care, you know, I think my mom is very ill in her mind and I think she tried, but was not able to be a mother to me. So, and I still feel that way even now. I think she's very sad about the situation, but in even a letter she wrote to me, she stated she could see that we would need to be separate for a time because she's not able to live in a way that is actually caring to me. And so, you know, I what I think is amazing is that she was able to recognize it. And and yet she also is not able to change that I've seen in 30 some years, and I'm not willing to risk it anymore, you know?
Right.
Yep.
So yes, about the maternal piece for sure. And it's hard. It's hard. But I'm grateful because I do have older women in my life that I can talk to. Like my mother-in-law is a wonderful support, and I work with women who are older, and I've had neighbors who I'm connected with who've been so kind. And, you know, meeting wonderful. You two is such a wonderful thing. So
it
I
is.
Think, I think God gives us, opportunities to connect with people. I do think it takes courage to connect. It takes courage to let yourself be known and to take the leap and live in your story for what it is.
Right. So, you know, and kind of staying on that, Carol, and I love that talking about a mom. It's true because let's talk about some other things about when you really break the nucleus of the family apart. There just really isn't a lot that we're losing. I mean, I've learned after all of these years living away from them, how much better I've gotten. My children are better. It was just constant chaos and pain when I was there. And so, and the lack of not being able to be authentic, right? So like if I went to the table, I certainly couldn't tell my story. Or if I did, you know, I was kind of silenced. So it was, it's kind of like, you know, going out to a dinner party and everybody's talking about their childhood and bringing up good stories. And, you know, that happens a lot in life. And then all of a sudden, I think.
And you're like, what am I going to add here?
So I actually did a blog post about, I'm sorry, you can't tell your story, because you know what? I can never tell my story. And yet, You know, so it feels so good to be with people where you can, but being in families like that, you sit around a table and you learn to bullshit because that's what everybody does, right? Like, you don't bring your pain to the table. You bring this inauthentic self that's usually taking care of the abuser because it's an abuser-centric, you know, world.
Yeah.
It's just funny how that goes. And so if they're hiding one abuser, so they're going to hide all abusers, right? So what else, you guys, do these families, I mean, because if you really break it down, what are we leaving behind? Not a ton, right?
Not much.
Sadly.
That's a real hard one for me. And I do think my family had a lot of really good things that were going on, which is pretty unusual, I think, in this context. Yeah, and it's been very hard for me not to feel tremendous loss there. But, you know, I have to be around people that support me. I have to be around people that are willing to, be there, listen to me. I just can't do that anymore where, you know, people are fighting me and questioning, you know, what I've been through. I just don't need that, you know? So, but I think that's a good point, Jody, like what are you really letting go of, you know? Not real healthy environments, so.
Right.
Yeah.
I think what you said about the, finish, Carol.
No, that's all right. I think you can't emphasize enough that sexual abuse is a disaster for families. There's no other way around it. It is an absolute disaster. It's like setting a bomb off in a family. And we try to keep it all together and, you know, not keep our role or whatever for a lot of years. And then you just have to let go. You just, you know, because the bomb's gone off. We haven't had anything to do with it. You know, we're not responsible in any way. And yet, you know, that's why it's so horrible. That's the main reason it's so horrible, that these are families that are already full of dysfunction, or this the sexual abuse wouldn't work. You know, the incest wouldn't be happening if you had people listening to you and supportive and all,
or listening to each other.
They're each other, right? You know, all those good things. Right. And free of any kind of, you know, the alcoholism, drug abuse.
Right.
It takes many systems to allow incest to occur, you know. And so I think, you know, that bomb we're dealing with all the time. And, and you know, particularly with incest, it occurs, you know, sexual abuse occurs in certain ways, but incest occurs much younger and much longer usually than any kind of other kind of sexual abuse. So it's extremely disastrous. And at any level, you know, a 10-year-old starts talking about it, an adolescent starts talking about it, or a 20-year-old or a 35-year-old, like kind of Jody and I were doing. It's a different ball game, and it's perceived as differently.
Yeah.
And I think it's really important to kind of respect those issues that go on too, you know? So like you say, I could go on about that, but
no, it's good. Go ahead. I mean, it's very true.
It's very true. And this whole thing of your family not believing you, which is what usually happens, has a lot to do too with how you remembered it. Did you always know this was going on, or did it come to you when you were much older? And all of a sudden, you know, you have this horrible reality that affects a whole lot about whether that family's gonna believe you, not believe you, you know, and support you in any way. So there's a lot of aspects to how it impacts the family. You know,
there is. And with that, Carol, most often, and you can do the research on this, when you have a pedophile in a house, pedophiles don't skip over children. They just don't do it. It's not in the statistics. It's not anywhere. If there's a family member who was raped for years and years and years, you can almost be sure there's another one. And I don't care who says that's not true. It's just not factual. Pedophiles abuse all kids. They don't hop over, you know, like, oh, I'm not going to, you know, that kind of thing. Usually. And so the reason I say that is when other siblings come against other siblings, it's usually so that they don't have to identify their own story. But Emily, go ahead.
Interesting.
Yeah, I feel like my family has tried to carefully construct themselves, if that makes sense. Like, they want to craft this perfect family environment, so everything is very planned and very controlled and very crafted to please my mother, crafted to make my mother look good, crafted to keep my father comfortable. He has type 1 diabetes, and I think that's a big piece of it. So what you said, Jody, about being around a table, it's all about making sure that my mom knows that we're all appreciative and that she can be behind the scenes, but we all know that it's really all this work she's done to create a memory. So it's all very like shiny, and it all needs to be shiny all the time for the
surface.
And keep that
curb appeal going. Right.
Yeah, to themselves.
The curb appeal,
like, this,
yes.
This could happen in a complete vacuum. It's like, we need to keep this up for ourselves. Right. And we need to make sure that these two, who's now the grandfather and the grandmother, are like catered to, but they make it look, my mom in particular makes it look like she's catering to everyone else, but what's actually going on is so she can see herself as being in service to everyone. So it's very weird.
So so you're saying it's self-fulfilling.
Yes, right. Exactly. And it's everyone else plays along, right? It's very wearying. And if a child deviates from that, neither of my parents can handle it. And so when my child came along and she was being a normal child, neither of my parents could handle it. And that's when I knew, like, this isn't safe. This isn't safe. Yes. Yep. So in terms of what I've lost, you know, I was fine playing the role until I had a child who was like not able to, and I saw how ugly it was. And
she didn't understand the rules.
And she was just being herself, right?
Yeah,
and
the then, unspoken rules.
what I realized is that there's not, the times with the family are not actually loving. They're just a charade. And And in terms of, there are some good things that are sad to lose. I do agree with you, Carol. But at the same time, I was injured. I was hemorrhaging, right? Mm-hmm. Like I needed help, and no one really cared to help because they all wanted to keep up the shiny charade. And if they knew separately that I was going through something, what shocked me is that any communication about any of it was put on me. So I was abused starting at age 7. I spoke up about it at age 9. The punishment was put on me. I spoke up about it at age 12.
Oh,
it was shut
horrible.
Down and I had to carry it. When I tried to discuss with them, every time it's like, well, this is your thing.
Gosh.
And you're going to have to heal, and we hope you get through it. And we've never had a family conversation about it. And I decided
it's abhorrent.
I'm so sorry, Emily.
I know. Well,
you say, which I'm still horrified, you were beaten from it? Didn't your father at one point beat you?
Unbelievable. So to me, the whole thing is such a fake. That I didn't feel sad about leaving that part at all. I was happy because it felt like escaping from a horrible scary, awful, right, dream.
You were escaping from a horrible, awful dream, but it wasn't a dream.
Good for you, Emily, protecting your child. You know, your child has to go first, has to come first. And you know, like Jody has said, you need to get away from these families. Mm-hmm. If they're not facing up to the sexual abuse and all these things, even if they didn't personally do it, these are systems that are very, very mm-hmm. damaging. And you got to get your kids away, you know? Yep. I think that's rule number one.
Well, it is. And that actually leads me right into the other thing that I wanted to talk about. So we talked about what it looks like to go and all of those things, but talk about the cost of staying. This mm-hmm. is another way to say it. The cost of staying is huge. And I heard you say, Emily, when my daughter, and then all of a sudden you see your daughter being treated like that and you're like, oh no, can do this to me, but you will not do this to my children. The cost of staying is huge, you guys. I did a blog post called The Cost of Healing Delayed. And so it delays your healing, but there's a high cost to that. And the other part that's really horrible is when people don't talk about abuse, they could mm-hmm. be an abuser. I'm not going to go point my finger at people and say, but the truth is that a lot of people that have been abused do become abusers. And now all of a sudden you're going to bring your children around these people who are not talking about it, who are keeping it hidden. Mm-hmm. I cannot tell you guys how many family members I have gone to and said, that man is not safe. There is this, 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 and this. I mean, there were bloody underwear, all these things. You know what people say? Oh no, Jody, you're just this person that wants to look. You're the person that maybe does just not even going to help yourself if you just don't be quiet. I have done everything I can to keep these people safe. And you know what they still just do? Oh no, they don't want to burden their own life by protecting a child. They'd rather go on and have a cupcake or whatever the hell they're doing. I don't know what's more important. But this, the cost to stay in these families is huge, you guys. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, as soon as I got memories that I had been molested, you know, and it was like just in one moment, I finally realized what was so wrong in my life. And it was like, I couldn't have anything to do with my father again. It was it. I knew it was over that minute. And I know a lot of people kind of keep skirting along. But I also think, I just couldn't do it. And it was, you know, it was very hard on everybody. My siblings completely rallied around my father for the next 30 years. He was just worship till the day he died. And
that's that's sad to me. That's tragedy. And, you know, when we talk about loss, it's okay. I actually really do grieve that my mother and my father were not different people. You know, it's a sincere grief that I have. I've healed to the point where I'm pretty indifferent with my mom anymore. You long to have a mother, but I don't long to have her arms because her arms were very hurtful and she's never changed, but it is
and
okay.
She's still alive.
She is still alive. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she is. And you know what? I every once in a while will reach out to her, but then I think, why did I do that? Why did I expect a different answer?
Yes.
And so I don't really put my hard expectation up, but I just always think, damn, I really wish that you'd be a different person. So I keep myself safe. I keep my children and grandchildren at a far, far distance. But Emily, talk about that a little bit. I think that it's okay for us to feel the loss. That's to me a healthy thing. I think grief is a positive thing that we need to be okay with, right?
Yeah.
And going back to the cost of staying, I mean, I think for me, in order to stay, I had to stay compartmentalized. Like I had to keep my real needs out of my consciousness so that I could proceed with the family. Because my needs were so opposite of what the family was doing. So the cost of it was further damage to myself. And, you know, promoting the dysfunction. So that's what I was doing. And then when my child came along, the cost of staying was me being stressed out all the time when I was with my parents, because I was constantly vigilant. Yeah. And I set up boundaries with them of like, these are the rules. This is what we're going to do. Cause I was trying to stay in relationship with protection.
Mm-hmm.
And that was just like, there's no relaxing then because.
Oh, that's so, it's so much work. I've been gone for a long time, but it is so much work.
It was very hard and there was no trust and there was no true friendship because it was just like management and fear. And then when the patterns started towards my daughter, as she got to be her own person, you know, around 18 months old, then the cost was seeing them start to be so mean to her. And then there was conflict because I stood up for her and I was like, you're not going to do this.
Right.
And then that heightened my dad's behavior because he's a bully. So if you speak against him, he'll increase. Mm-hmm. He's volatile and very haughty. So if I spoke up, then he would just, it would magnify what he did. So it was not comfortable. It was always felt like more pain, more wounds.
Yeah.
So the cost of staying was having to then go to a few more therapy sessions just to get over that visit. And became a cycle of drama. And I was like, this is not love. And there's no changing this. This is how my family lives. So it's like,
well, it keeps wounds open, doesn't it?
Yeah. So it's interesting because there's that shiny side of the family that my mom's trying to maintain all the time. Mm-hmm. So I was trying to like play into that. And then there's this volatile bully of my father. So it was a constant tension and trying to keep everyone happy and me from getting too hurt and my daughter from getting too hurt and not good. So the cost was mental health.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I, you know, Lord knows when we're trying to recover, our heads are blowing off anyway with issues, right? We have so much going on. And when, you know, I would go to some of my family events, extended family, and I would just get lectured that this never happened. And how could you do this? And telling my kids, I had relatives that went up to my adult kids and said, you know, your mother is just lying. This never happened. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Big stuff. And telling my nieces and nephews, you know, that this is never happened. And this is after, you know, I'm just trying so hard to keep my head above water, you know.
Exactly.
And, yeah. And it's
so sad.
And I kept trying to make everything okay. You know, I guess I have a lot of that in me, you know. And I want to throw out a question here. I'd like to hear you guys' opinions of how much does love play into this? Where do you see love? Is it that you had no love for these people, or, you know, how is that perceived in this walking away from family?
I think that's a complicated question because I think that love first has to be defined. When I was with my family of origin, I actually used to say something to myself when I was young. You guys, this is going to sound weird, but I used to tell myself, I don't want love. I want kindness. Because the love I knew had no kindness in it. Mm-hmm. And I remember coming through the years thinking, if this is love, then I'll just look for kindness because I don't want this. And so
interesting.
It's
very smart.
You were perceptive. That was really
a young girl. Yeah.
Well,
very protective of your core, you know?
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. Well, right. Cause there was such cruelty. So I think that the love card is so complicated with them, but really it's a toxic trauma bond. Mm-hmm. And toxic trauma bonds feel stronger than real love bonds do because real love gives freedom. Real love doesn't make you feel guilt. Real love doesn't make you feel shame. Toxic, disgusting, destroying love makes you feel shame, makes you feel guilt, makes you feel a responsibility for the abuser. So I think that when you uncomplicate your mind with what real love looks like, then I'm kind of hard pressed to say, I forgive you, but do I have to love you? Then, you know what I mean? So it gets a little bit, the lines.
That's really important what you said. Yeah, really important.
The lines
that
aren't
I, that we have to define love really carefully.
We do.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's, yeah, I don't know. How do you feel about that, Emily?
Well, you know, I think I love the core of who my parents are.
Yeah.
Because I know that God made them, you know, like they are important people. They, every soul is important. But I cannot and I don't want to love the way they act and the way they choose to live. And so I'm not going to say it's okay for them to be that way. I don't actually think that's loving them, because then that's like promoting them living in evil. Mm-hmm. And that's not loving them to endorse them living in with cruelty towards others. So I feel it's more loving to tell the truth and to challenge their narratives and their way.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they're growing, maybe they're changing when I'm not there. That's not my responsibility. I'm not,
right.
You know, but I think that love has truth. So if you're living in a relationship based on lies, that's not love. And an actual loving way to be is in truth. And I don't think that that involves necessarily being like, I think you can be in truth without being actively hurtful towards another person. Like you can communicate truth, if that makes sense. Like in what I've tried to do, I've tried so hard to speak to my family with honesty and truth, but also love. Mm-hmm. And in terms of their love for me, I don't know. I don't know that there's, I have not felt genuine love. I felt love towards what they want me to be. So if I follow their expectation of me, then I feel an approval that to them is love because it serves them. But actual me, I don't feel much love towards who I truly am.
Because they don't think they really know who you really are.
Right. And if I try to engage with them in who I really am, they can't handle it because it's living in a different reality that they can't enter into without their own self-perception falling apart, if that makes sense.
Right.
It's kind of complicated. But then in terms of other people's perception of me towards my parents, of my choice, that's been very mixed. So I've had a couple family members who are supportive. I've had one aunt who said she's so proud of me and she wants me to write a memoir, right? So she sees it as she loves me for what I've done and who I am. And I have a cousin who's that way too, which I'm so grateful for. But then I have other family members who have accused me of having a seed of Satan planted in me. And
oh God, that sounds like my father. He used to tell me that like, all the time.
Yeah, so right. I've had a big mix of people who have one idea of what forgiveness and reconciliation looks like, and other people who are willing and able to engage with me. So I know I'm loved by those people, and the others, I don't think they understand or will.
Carol, how would you answer that question?
I think I see, like with my mother passing away way before any of this came to light, I have to look back at her and think, you know, she wasn't who I wanted her to be. She had all kinds of emotional baggage, alcoholism, everything. But I now feel like I know the core of her was good. I believe that in people, that the core of them is good and loving. And you see that in glimpses of people, even when they do horrible things. So it felt like love to me, but I think even talking here, I'm going to think more about that. I mean, love is not approval, but as a child, it feels like that. Mm-hmm. When you get a parent's approval, it feels like love. My father used to rub my arm and smile at me. Mm-hmm. And I thought, that's really love. But that was before I knew about everything that he was doing. So no, I don't know. I think you walk away from people even when you still love them.
Yeah, I do.
You know,
too.
I think that's kind of where my head's going with that, that you can still love them, but mm-hmm. cannot be around them. And mm-hmm.
You know, I think another thing that happens in particularly families of incest is we get this kind of magical thinking. And I wonder if this magical thinking comes from them. And it sounds something like this. I'm going to love you enough to change you, to make your life better, to make you happy. I'm going to bring enough love and fix to this family that everything's going to be okay. And we're going to mm-hmm. live happily ever after.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And you know what I learned is what good did my love do any of them? Nothing. I remember when my father was dying, all of a sudden it was like, I heard God say to me, Jody, look and see what good my love couldn't do nothing to help or fix them. Nothing. Mm-hmm. God's love. They, you know, it's grace and mercy, right? Like you guys need a power way above who I am. And I am hard pressed to actually see the goodness in my parents. And I know people are going to not like me saying that, but as I get older and have lived, and honestly, you guys, look at the demonstration of who they were. Mm-hmm. It has been cruelty after cruelty after mm-hmm. cruelty. Mm-hmm. I have watched my brother almost destroy himself because incest wants you dead. Do not get me wrong. Incest wants you dead. And they will do nothing to step in and intervene. He's had his fifth heart attack. He drinks, he smokes. He's been snorting whatever he could snort mm-hmm. since he was in his 20s. Do you think anybody cares? Mm-hmm. So I'm hard pressed to see that there's mm-hmm. any good in people that won't step in their own flesh and blood and say, oh my God, mm-hmm. I've given you a fatal wound. Could I please do something to help? Yeah. They don't care.
No.
So just that's
really something to hear you say that, Jody, mm-hmm. that this will kill you.
Yes.
This will kill you.
Yes.
And you can't forget that. How many people commit suicide over this or kill themselves? Mm-hmm. With addiction and on, and it's a fight for your life.
It
right?
is, right? And nobody helped me fight for my life. You guys, rather they held my head underwater and said, "Try to find air." And after mm-hmm. years of having my head underwater and drinking, I mean, trying to breathe like a fish when I was a human, I gave up. And I said, you guys are still, you're trying to kill me. Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's not giving life, what's it giving? It's giving death to me. Mm-hmm. You know, you cannot, in matters of this kind of thing, I really feel that God has put this huge thing on my heart to say, go make a strong line, and particularly mm-hmm. with incest, because people are dying in these lines.
Yes.
You know what, you guys, they're dying and they're not making it out. And then people are hiding pedophiles because they got to look good. Excuse me? So you're going to let a child get raped in the back room so that you can look good? Excuse me?
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly what happened in my family.
What the hell is going on?
The ease of ignoring is shocking. And it is the complete opposite of love. It's complete self-centeredness. And
that's, yes.
Are they in contact with this, you know, quote, brother of yours?
Yes. So I have verbalized it. Feel that they have chosen him over me because this is how I see it. This was their project. They took this on and this troubled person welcomed them into their home, got him through his adolescence. They're his family, but at the cost of me, which they need to keep hidden.
Well, they make him look good. They and make, they make themselves look good. Yes. We're the good parents, right?
Have you looked into pressing charges on him?
So I have been asked that from the first time I called the employee assistance program of my husband when I fell apart, right? Yeah. Finally fell apart. And I have not. And partly because, well, the statute of limitations, and it was a gray area because he was only 4.5 years older than I was. And by law, it has to be 5 years in California.
Is that right?
Yeah. Wow. And with my father, I can't remember if I was over 18 when he finally actually assaulted me. He was hinting at things, objectifying me, commenting about my body, you know, all sorts of kind of freaky, yucky things. But then when an actual assault occurred, I can't place how old I was. So it's really like I don't have enough for there to be something there. I have reported my sister's family to Child Protective Services because I'm very concerned about how they treat their children. Because she's still in it. She's still.
Is that right?
She's still in the charade. She's still and completely, you know, connected to my parents.
I love that you brought that up, Carol, about doing what you can. I also went to the local authorities with my mom. With my mother did indecent exposure. She took baths in front of me as a child, in front of my nephew, and then my daughter. That's three generations, you guys, when I started talking about it. So I did call because should anything happen, and anybody that's listening, if you have the strength to protect the people behind you, call a local authorities just to say, I don't need to press charges for myself, but I want this on record to protect the people behind me, because if they come forward, they've got cooperation, because if we don't start creating cooperation, these crimes, you guys, they're the best crimes of hell, because like that sibling incest is right behind father-daughter incest. And guess what? It's not prosecutable most of the time. This is, you guys, these are crimes of hell that we've got to start doing something about to help. And it's, our voices are our biggest power. Yes, our voices are our biggest power.
Well, thank you for that challenge. I've just had such a hard time with the whole growth process.
Very, very difficult.
And I need to think on it and decide if and how to do that. Because I have thought on it and haven't taken action. So, except for calling about my sister, because I felt like that was something that was, I had something real, like solid enough.
Yeah. And the unfortunate fact is that they're not going to probably do anything. So, you know, if you think the whole world's going to come crashing on them, that's not really how it goes. You'll be very lucky if they do anything. It's like calling CPS.
It's true. However, his name will be in the system.
Yes,
and if he ever abuses,
documented.
If he ever abuses again, you've got cooperation. And that is something that, if every abuser on this planet went to our court systems and asked for help, they would be overran. There was this whole article about it because there's so many people in hiding. But remember, if you're listening, somebody else, abusers don't just touch one person. I mean, it's almost unheard of. So to start cooperation for other people who are hurt, everybody go tell. Just even say, I don't want anything from you, but I want this on the record.
Yes.
So that he, in case he abuses again, this won't happen. Because you break down a pedophile one secret at a time. So just start exposing those secrets. Yeah. It really is true.
That's absolutely true. Yeah.
And, you know, Carol, didn't you tell me one time that your brother came to you, too, about some sexual hanky-panky? You know, this is funny, Emily. Carol and I were chatting, and it could have been before we were actually recording, because we often do this.
Yeah.
But she said her brother came to her, and my brother came to me in my 20s and said, don't you remember what we used to do?
This?
Yeah, and I'm like, no, actually, I don't.
Yeah, I know. I think that,
And so the thing about these stories is it takes years and years, because there are real big fatal wounds, and then there's all these little fatal wounds that happen to us. And sibling incest usually is not as great, although I did go through a couple memories of my brother, and it was really violent, and I didn't want it. And I love that he said what we did. And then when Carol said that too, her brother came to her and said, it's not what we did. Exactly. No. My brother raped me. And, you know, I went to my mom and said, Mom, Mark raped me. And you know what she said? Oh, Jody, he lived in the same house. He got the same abuse you did. Just let it go, basically. Wow. So everybody can rape everybody because we just come from a raping household. That was her honest answer to me. And I just thought, what the fuck? I mean, I'm sorry, but honestly, it's like, seriously?
And you know, you can't say enough about how mothers are not standing up.
They're not.
For their child. And I think about it, like, how much of it is just financial? You know, I don't know, but I mean, women have got to be able to support their own families so they can walk away when there's any kind of problem, you know, they have to protect their children. And I hear this over and over again. It's just so keeps it going. It's unbelievable.
I have not heard a story where they're like, no, my mom was really strong and confronted everything. It doesn't exist.
Right. It because doesn't happen.
Abusers have to get a person who keeps the narrative alive and makes the family look good. And they're all both looking good together. Like you said, Carol, the systems are so horribly, miserably broken in these families. Mm-hmm. And so
the whole system,
it really is true. Well, we're at time, you guys. Is there anything that you'd like to say before we go? I think there was a ton in this. I loved that comment that someone said, thank you. This was so helpful. And it's really different listening to people who have the experience and have lived through it, walking through it. I believe that I'm going to be healing till I go back to God one day.
Me
and
too.
You know, and so I think it's so beautiful. I just want to thank you guys again for being here. Next week, I've got an interview with someone else, but we'll continue to do these panels because I just think they're beautiful. But if you guys would like to leave anything that you feel is really important, because I am going to give you guys the accolades that you deserve. You guys are both putting in and have put in the hard work to be where you sit today and who you are. And so I'd love to give you a minute just to say anything that you'd like to.
No, just, you know, to be speaking up and say it often, because if your family has sexual abuse, it's going to happen to the next generation if you're not really on your game.
It will happen to the next generation.
It will happen. And this goes on and on. And when people tell you it's not true, to forget about it, just move on, that those are not supportive people. Those are not good people to have in your life. So.
Is it my turn?
Yes.
Well, all I'm thinking about is I have work to do. And so if you're feeling that way, you're not alone. Like, I think I'm in the midst of it. I'm in the midst of still having more come to light. And so we're in, all of us are in this together, growing. And what I think is so valuable is to come together to share and to learn from each other and be challenged to take the next step.
That's so beautiful. Yeah. It's so true. I wanted to leave with this one really kind of cool story. Everybody knows the story of Noah. God comes to him. He says, build this ark. Noah begins to build this ark. People make fun of him. It takes him years and years and years, but then there's no rain and then the rain starts. I bet people weren't making fun of him. But the point that I wanted to bring up about this story is in Genesis 7:16, it says, the animals going in were male and female of every living thing, as God had commanded Noah. And the next thing is hugely important. It says, then the Lord shut him in. And I guess for anybody listening, it's really hard to get out of incestuous families. And may God shut you in this week. May he give you the strength to do the things that you need to do. But I love that. If he wouldn't have shut Noah in, I assume Noah would have kept that door open. To Carol's point about how we love family, we don't know how to shut him out. Noah probably would have let everything on that was trying to actually, God was trying to get rid of. Whether you believe the story or not, I think it's a wonderful concept of God shut the door for me, because sometimes we let shit in that we just really shouldn't. So anyway, if you like what we're doing, please hit subscribe, share, follow us, and let us know by comment or send me an email about anything that you'd like us to to discuss. We'd be happy to do that. I've worked all day. I'm tired. We love you. Have a wonderful day. Let's keep breaking down those pedophiles one
That's
secret at a
right.
time. We'll see you next time. Love
Yeah,
you guys.
thank you.
Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.